like I finally ran into someone that likes to play as rough as I do.
Yeah, this must be your lucky night.
I'm lucky? I guess maybe I am. But you're dumb. Real dumb if you think you can pull this off.
I think you're forgetting something. I got the gun.
I can get guns, smart guy, lots of them. Now, why don't you tell me your name?
Tom Cody. Pleased to meet you.
I'll be coming for her. And I'll be coming for you, too.
Sure you will. And I'll be waiting.
Hello everyone, welcome to episode 14 of The Bloody Pit. I just wanted to jump in here real quick before the show actually begins to give you a little bit better introduction to the two people who are joining me on this episode. Ted Haycraft is a guy I've been lucky to get to know over the past few years, but unfortunately only get to see probably once or twice a year at the most. He and I almost invariably end up in conversations about music, usually Bob Dylan, the band, Robbie Roberts and Levon Helm, and things of that nature, but needless to say, as you will learn later in this podcast, he has a certain large chunk of knowledge about movies as well. In his hometown, he works at WFIE and does a good bit of work there. And connected with that, he does a thing called Cinema Chat, which is a show that broadcasts on that channel Monday through Friday from 11 to 12 in the morning. Oh, that would, you know, I don't live near it, but I wish I did. He also has hosted, as he'll mention in the podcast, a series of shows at the local library there in his hometown, where he screens and discusses different films. Most recently, several of the Coen Brothers films. One of my favorites, The Man Who Wasn't There, which is a truly interesting and bizarre film. But Ted is a heck of a guy, and this time around, instead of discussing music, he and I discuss this movie. But then again, this movie has a lot of music in it, and so the discussion still kind of bends back toward music anyway. Also joining us is filmmaker Robert Tennell, who I got to know for the first time several years ago, and was very happy to, mainly because I knew his film Frankenstein and Me. And since then, that came out in 97, but since then he's come out with several other documentaries and several other different films as well. And right now, as he mentions briefly in this show, he's working on a great documentary called That Shit Will Rot Your Brain, How the Monster Kids Transformed Popular Culture. I have seen a rough cut of this film, and it is going to be something wonderful. Even in rough form, it is a crowd-pleasing joy. Bob is best known these days for me as the guy who, for the past 10 years or so, has been writing some of my favorite independent horror comics. If you've never read The Black Forest and its sequel, or The Wicked West and its sequels, let me highly recommend them. And right now, the third volume of his comic book, Flesh and Blood, which he does with artist Neil Volks, is out. And man, if you're a Hammer fan and Hammer film fan and a comic book fan, I cannot recommend Flesh and Blood highly enough. Almost the continuing adventures of Peter Cushing's Dr. Frankenstein. Flesh and Blood, well worth checking out, but Bob Tennell is a man of many talents, and this is a fun broadcast. I posted something on Facebook recently about having recently rewatched Walter Hill's 1984 film Streets of Fire, and these two guys chimed in along with a few other people, and both of them were quite happy to indulge me and sat down and talked about this movie. So, if you've never seen Streets of Fire, listen up. If you have seen Streets of Fire, listen up as well, as we babble for an hour plus about this great film.
I'll be coming for her, and I'll be coming for you, too.
Sure you will, and I'll be waiting.
You are about to enter a world unlike any you've ever seen before, where rock and roll is king. The only law is a loaded gun, where the beautiful
today and see the show. It's really good.
The brutal.
I want Tom Cody.
And the brave all meet.
From now on, it's for real.
In Streets of Fire.
You're lying in your bed and on a Saturday night. You're sweating buckets and it's not even hard. But your brain has got the message and it's sending it out to every nerve and every muscle you got. You got so many dreams that you don't know where to put them, so you better turn a few of them loose. Your body's got a feeling that it's starting to rust. You better rev it up and put it to use. And I don't know how I ever thought that I could make it all alone. When you all
from the creators of 48 Hours, Universal Pictures presents Michael Paré, Diane Lane, Rick Moranis, and Amy Madigan in a Walter Hill film, Streets of Fire.
Hello, welcome to the Bloody Pit. This is Rod Barnett once again, and I'm here with two guests today to talk about a film that, honestly, unfortunately, not a lot of people know about. I'm here with two folks. One is Bob Snell.
How is it going? Thank you for having me, because I love this film.
You are...
Well, I'm sorry, I am being an idiot, too.
No, that's all right. Don't worry, being an idiot is par for the course anytime I'm around. So. But I would just call you a filmmaker.
I'm a filmmaker. You know, and I'm down here in Louisville. We just screened my film that expletive deleted will rot your brain, a rough cut.
Believe me, you can say it. I slap an explicit label on
it. Well, I'm really, because I haven't really decided yet if that's what it is.
Is that going to be the final title?
I think it is going to be the final title.
I think it's good, because that is the phrase that we all heard growing up about all these movies.
That shit's going to rot your brain.
And, exactly.
And plus, I have a new movie coming out shortly called The Hunted that I've produced, that Josh Stewart directed, which is a pretty cool found footage horror movie.
I didn't know it was found footage. Okay,
it is. It's pretty creepy. We have a little premiere in West Virginia next week. Actually, it's going to be hitting theaters in the area. So I'm pretty excited about it.
Cool. Also with us is Ted Haycroft.
Hey, I'm from Evansville, Indiana. We're here in Louisville too, just hanging out. I've been doing movie reviews off and on since I was in high school, and currently I work at a TV station. I do a thing called Cinema Chat, and I'm on every 2 weeks. On the midday show, just chatting about whatever I want about cinema, comic books, and everything else.
Wow, it's really that free form?
Pretty free form, yeah. It's up to me what I want to do. So
wow,
it's kind of
wow.
Fun.
Is it,
and I'll do things like Streets of Fire, you know.
Well, we are here to talk about one of the lesser-known Walter Hill films. Walter Hill is a director. He got his start as a screenwriter in Hollywood. Was actually well-known enough in... I guess really kind of even outside of certain Hollywood circles that he was able to parlay it into a directorial career, and he's still directing today, although I think that the last time one of his films was a massive hit was decades ago.
It's been a while.
It's been quite a while.
His latest one was with Stallone.
Yeah, Bullet to the Head, which...
I was kind of excited about, because it was like... I thought, he's back into his action genre.
Actually, I enjoyed it. I didn't see it until video, but I enjoyed it. But it was kind of fun to notice that he does steal from himself in Bullet to the Head. There's a climactic axe battle between Stallone and Jason Momoa that copies the climactic sledgehammer scene from the end of this movie. So,
well, I said, you know, he always Walter Hill always sort of reminded me of Howard Hawks. And there was I remember one time in American Film Magazine or something, somebody said Howard Hawks would steal from anybody. He'd even steal from himself, you know, because he made Rio Bravo like three times, right?
Exactly.
And I think it was pretty cool the way that it's pretty simple cinema. It almost goes back to the, you know, the old silent movies of the girls tied to the train tracks and the train's coming and will the hero get there before she, you know, that's pretty much what Walter Hill does, right? He's like, mm-hmm. We got to get from point A to point B, And he just really uses sort of basic cinematic techniques to get you there.
He's really proud, too, that he doesn't, that he likes to get rid of dialogue, just the actions speak it. You know, the for character and for that, and for the story, you know.
And that's one of the things I love the most about Streets of Fire. And I'm, from what I understand, it's one of the things that was most criticized about Streets of Fire, which is that the dialogue in it, it's almost every single line could be called a cliche. In other words, you've heard all of this dialogue before, and if I didn't know better, and I'd love to pigeonhole him one day and ask him, it almost feels as if every single line of dialogue was pulled directly from the script of a film noir. Sometime in the 40s, he just sat down with this massive database of lines and went, yeah, that'll work here, and just plunked it down. But it works beautifully because that's the kind of story he's telling.
He's telling a straightforward story. I mean, look at the performances. It's not like people aren't smirking their way through the lines. They know they're very much in on the joke. I mean, I remember at the time Michael Pare's performance was criticized heavily. But actually, I think he was just doing what it was
what Walter wanted.
Which was, you know, everybody was in on the joke. Deborah von Valkenburg, you know, plays Tom Cody's sister. Yeah. I mean, every line she delivers, she finishes the line like basically she curls her lips. She's just kind of, you know, it was a very self-conscious film, and I don't mean that in a bad way.
Look
how he arrives with the long coat, you know, and the rifle. I mean, where is he coming from? Yeah. You know, I mean, it's right out of the searchers.
I go everywhere with a Winchester. Don't leave home without one.
Wearing a long duster. Yeah, no matter where I go. Let's really quickly throw out that one of the reasons why this film could be called odd is first of all, it's described right on screen. One of the first things you see on screen is the film is described as a rock and roll fable, which will tell you right up front that a certain amount of rules are kind of out of bounds. There are certain things that you're going to see here that are not the standard thing for a film of any particular type, especially in 1984. And it's a mix of, strangely enough, musical, action,
the mashup,
drama, romance. There's a little bit of everything, and honestly, there's some really good comedy in it too. I think there's some really, really funny stuff.
Oh, Moranis is really funny.
Oh, Moranis is hysterical.
But, you know, I'm the weird guy. Like, it makes perfect sense because, like, one of my favorite movies is that old Universal Murder in the Blue Room.
Yeah,
which is a horror mystery comedy musical.
Yes,
written by like I.A.L. Diamond, who became Billy Wilder's screenwriter. Right,
very unique film.
It is a unique, wonderful film. You know, but it's friggin' weird.
But it's also as hard as hell to get your hands on.
It is. It's very hard, but you can get it. Anyway, that's another conversation.
Oh, well, that's a great film.
Well, let me read what Walter Hill wrote on the liner notes on the vinyl.
Oh, great.
This is Walter Hill's own words on the back of the soundtrack. It says, Streets of Fire is by design comic book in orientation, mock epic in structure, movie heroic in acting style, operatic in visual style, and cowboy cliche in dialogue. In short, a rock and roll fable where the leader of the pack steals the queen of the hop and Soldier Boy comes home to do something about it.
That's,
you know, it's funny. I love that he said this because I got to tell you, we were talking earlier. At the time the movie came out, I was working almost 95% of the work I was taking was in music videos. I was still in film school, but I was working, you know, just, and we were just working around the clock. And it really was the cliche I used to describe it. It was the Wild West. And for a lot of kids like me, would have never gotten a leg into the industry that we did if it hadn't been for music videos, because there was this enormous demand and there was nobody to do the work. So literally, you know, one week you were PA and the next week you were producer. And I am not exaggerating. It was like that. And they were throwing tons of money at it. I mean, no, as my father said back in the time, he goes, nobody should give an idiot like you that kind of money. You know, I mean, and it was true. He was absolutely right. So I remember vaguely when the film came out, because there were some billboards around LA, but you know, you sort of heard things, and it was like, oh, no, this movie's not going to be any good. This movie's no good. Walter Hill missed it. So I just didn't even go see it, and it was difficult to get away anyway because we were shooting so much. It seemed like it was within months that it was on HBO or Showtime or something.
Probably.
Which is where I saw it, yeah.
And my brother had seen it, and he said, I really think you better see this film. And I was instantly captivated by the title sequence, because the title sequence is just outstanding.
Yeah, it's just slash.
Oh, it's just wonderful.
I'd never seen anything like that.
I don't think it had been done before. No, it hadn't. Yeah. I mean, Walter Hill definitely was paying attention to whatever was going on with music videos in a much smarter way. But the thing that I took away, my takeaway from it at the time, now, and you know, put this in context. I don't want to, you know, we didn't say graphic novels then, and we, you know, things like Watchmen and stuff wasn't out yet.
Yeah, that was.
But there were things were happening in comics, and I'm watching this film and I'm going, "This is a comic book," and unlike, and I had worked previously as a kid. I'd worked as a PA on Creepshow. I know everybody loves Creepshow, but you know, as a comic book fan and also a horror fan, a Stephen King fan, and George Romero fan, I'm in heaven. But I kept saying, I don't think these guys understand that they're trying to make a movie look like a comic book. Movies and comic books are the same thing. Okay, it's not they're already comic. They already have so much in common. You don't put these weird frames and things up. Whereas I thought Walter Hill, he totally somehow did it. You know, he did it in his framing. He did it with the color. He did it. There was so much, but just, and also in just the wild, you know, mashups that he was doing.
Because, like, you know, you get the cars from the what is it, the 50s.
The cars are from the 50s. Some of the lights and some of the sets and some of the fashion is 1980s, early 80s.
I almost think Diane Lane's outfit in the beginning looks futuristic.
Yeah,
it almost does. She's from the future. Yeah. You know, it's just like, you know, from Legions of Superheroes or something. You know,
and they did that, by the way, in Looper. I thought was really smart. If you guys saw Looper,
was a fantastic film.
It really was. But they said, you know what, we're going to say that we're retrofitting these cars. We're going to do, you know, it's not in the movie, by the way. But when I interviewed Billy Bob Thornton for Rot Your Brain, we were talking about, because I don't want to get too much off on the side, but we were talking about how, you know, even the sort of the horror look of the 50s monster culture even kind of influenced cars, you know, like,
yes,
the, you know, the,
yeah,
fins and things like that, you know, look at the Batmobile, it's very monstery and stuff like that. And Billy Bob was saying, like, he'd seen some car and it was like a $150,000 car, and he goes, it just looked like a Buick. He's like, everything looks the same now. They're this kind of bubbled out shape.
Yeah.
You know, and it's true. And it isn't hard to imagine a world we're going to get to where people are trying to make cars have some personality again.
Right.
You know, and that was, I loved that the cars had so much personality.
Well, here's something that's kind of strange to me. We talk about how Streets of Fire has all these elements from the 50s. There's some modern elements circa 1980. There are a few elements that seem to be things out of the old West, like the duster that that mm-hmm. Michael Perret's character walks.
Which is right out of the Long Riders.
Yeah. Right, exactly. It looks like he stepped off that set into this one.
Biker movies, you know.
But one of the strange things, and of course I was a kid growing up in small town Tennessee, for God's sake. And so that opening sequence where he comes in and you don't know what the character, you don't know who he is and what his relationship to anybody is at that point. And he slaps that guy around and who's rousting his sister's restaurant and takes that butterfly knife away from him. That was the first time I'd ever seen a butterfly knife.
Me too.
So to me, that was something so completely new that it to me, as I'm that far into the film, for the first time I'm thinking, oh wow, they've created something too to add to these other elements. I didn't realize that was something that, If I were in an urban area or someplace with, you know, some kind of knowledge about actual hand weaponry, no, those have been around for years. I didn't know that. So to me, it was almost as if, oh, they're even throwing in things they created. They're not just taking things from the past and melding all together. They're actually creating something else. But that just added to the joy for me because I didn't know visually what was going to happen next. I didn't know, even at the age I was, I kind of saw what the structure of the story was right off the bat. But you never know how they're going to come at it. The details are where the joy is in a lot of this film.
Well, and also for that scene, the walking contradiction that is Tom Cody. Like, it's very, yes, it's funny to me because, you know, on the one hand, and I love it because Walter Hill just says, I'm going to have this character do whatever I need him to do. So he's I'm the iconic loner. I don't fit in. I don't do this. No, dude, you're a performance artist. You could have just beat that guy's ass, but he doesn't. He has to put on a show when he does it.
Uh-huh.
Right? He puts on a show with Willem Dafoe when he fights him. Everything he does is a show. And it always, the only thing in the movie that bothers me is one line where he says to and I realize later that I think that it was meant to be mocking himself when he says, I like shooting the guns and stuff, but I'm no hero, when he was in the Army. And then later, by the time you watch the end of the film, you're like, you know what? This guy probably took out, like, you know, 500 people. I think he's a hero. You know, he's...
Well, that's the... And going back to Hawks, I mean, because Hill's gonna reference back to those kind of things every chance he gets. That's the kind of action filmmaker he is in the first place. Those are the type of loner heroes who, honestly, most of the time, they probably don't think of themselves as heroes. They don't think of themselves as anything other than just a guy trying having to get something done. I've got a job, I've got to get done, and this is the these are the tools I have, and this is what I'm going to do to get it done. And that's the beauty of Tom Cody. The idea of him being, I don't want to say stereotype, it's an archetype. He is that action hero at the dead center of a story that everything swirls around, and he just has to cope with everything and try to make his way through it the best he can, dragging the good people or the innocent people behind him and hoping he can help them. That's the basic kind of story. It's a Western. I mean, in a lot of ways, John Carpenter always talks about how, you know, every one of my movies is really just a Western and dressed up in a different way. Well, it's true.
Well, yeah, and it was funny too because it took a while for Hill to really do a true Western. He always wanted to do a pure Western.
And, yes.
I was going to say, you guys saw it on cable or HBO. I saw it in the theater. Here, little backstory on my entry into it was, I loved Walter Hill. I had seen Long Riders. I dragged friends back to that. I saw Southern Comfort. Ry Cooder was doing the soundtracks, and I just fell so deep for Walter Hill and his filmography at that time. And then 48 Hours came along, and I thought, okay, this is good. I love it, but everybody else loves it. It was a huge hit. I said, well, that's good. He'll get to do what he wants to do. Even though I was like thinking, okay, now everybody's in on the game on his, and I wanted more Long Riders and Southern Comfort, and not star driven, big budget vehicles. Well, I don't know if 40 Hours was that big a budget though. Anyway, so Streets of Fire starts getting promoted. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is going to be the ultimate Walter Hill film. It's going to be an action film married with music videos. And music videos, like you said, was the thing, right? That everybody was just, MTV, everything was blowing up. I thought, this is just going to be the ultimate film. And it was supposed to be the big, giant summer budget film. It came out on June 1st, 1984. I rushed to the theater that weekend. I saw two films that weekend, same day. And I was... I did a blog about this called I Wept, and Once Upon a Time in Indiana, I Wept, because I saw Once Upon a Time in America that same day.
Oh,
and
wow. Oh, my Lord.
Yeah, and Leone's my God. You know, I love Walter Hill, but Leone, you know, I grew up going to drive-in multiple times. And
of course.
I'm at the right age. That was my Star Wars trilogy. The Man with No Name trilogy was my Star Wars trilogy. You know, right. So I thought, and I knew going in it was a chopped-down version. And I watched that thing, and I was just, like, brokenhearted. Then I would turn around and watch Streets of Fire, and my expectations were so high, coming off what I loved about Walter Hill, everything, that I was somewhat disappointed, because it was not going to match, and I was also just brokenhearted about the Leone film. So I go, okay, well, I need to go see the Leone film before he goes off, because who knows when he'll do another film, and I want to see it, even as butchered it is. I grab my friend, we go back on Monday to the theater to see Once Upon a Time in America, and there was only one showing at night, and we missed it. The whole point of that thing being cut down was to have multiple showings. So I'm like, okay, well, let's go see Streets of Fire again. And because I go, it's Walter Hill, you need to see this. So we went in Streets of Fire, and then my love and my expectations were down, and I started falling in love with it, and then I couldn't get enough of it after a while. But it was, at first, I was a little let down, I think, because I just rushed into it thinking this was going to be the ultimate Walter Hill film. And it is actually the ultimate Walter Hill film.
Well, in a lot of ways, it's a culmination of the movies he'd made. I mean, starting with The Warriors Forward, it's kind of those movies brought to a different, I don't want to say a different level, but he's kind of melded them all together in a way.
Tequila.
Hey, Tom Cody. It's been a long time, pal. How's your hammer hanging?
How's it going, Clay?
Well, not so hot. I got beat up trying to save your old girl.
I could use a little help with those guys. You should have been there, Tom.
It'd been like the old days when we were in school. We'd have kicked ass.
Hey, bartender. You gonna shoot the shit all night or you wanna give me another drink?
Hey, Tom, would you get a load of this little honey? She thinks she owns the place.
I'm just trying to get myself a drink, pal.
Well, maybe you've already had enough, babe.
You gotta be kidding me.
Do I look like I'm kidding? No, maybe you ought to pay up as well. I've been driving up a tab here all night. We're not real big on credit.
Are you trying to say that I can't pay?
Yeah, let's see the color of your money.
There, happy?
Yeah, but now I don't like your face.
You know, everywhere I go, there's always an asshole. You got any preferences?
I've always been a tequila man.
Let's get out of here. My name's McCoy. I'm a soldier. At least I was up until about a year ago. Ran out of wars.
Yeah? What's your spec?
Motor pool. Nothing fancy. But if it's got wheels, I can drive it and I can fix it.
That's funny. I just got out a couple months ago. Been R&R ever since.
Yeah, how'd you like the Army?
I like shooting the guns, but I didn't win no medal.
Hey! Is that your car?
I'm trying to... It was shortly before this that I had become acquainted with The Road Warrior, probably within about 18 months. I'd never seen it.
Yeah.
And L.A. had this awesome channel called the Z Channel.
Oh, gosh, yes.
I've seen the documentary.
Fantastic,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I started watching The Road Warrior, and it seemed like I was watching it every, you know, 3 or 4 hours. And I just... You know, I still consider it. It's just, I think it's an absolutely perfect film. There's one undercrank shot that I don't.
And you missed it at the theater?
I lived in West Virginia at the time, didn't make it to the theater.
Because, man, when that thing opened up, you know, and it went to widescreen, I literally went, you know, like that. It was just.
The montage of it, I mean, just nobody was doing that kind of cutting. I mean, in a sense, you know, of course Spielberg was. I mean, you can always go back in Jaws, Spielberg was doing all the really sort of amazing cutting. But I mean, when I saw Road Warrior, I was like, nobody's doing this. And then people were sort of watching music videos and trying to figure out what we were doing. And I say we, I mean, only because I was in the industry. I wasn't directing at the time. But really what was going on there was just you were just getting tons and tons of footage or, you know, and then finding a show inside of it. And I read an interesting thing once a few years ago that said, you know, at the beginning of the music video era, you know, the average person could only perceive a burst of 6 frames out of 24. So they could perceive an image if it lasted a quarter of a second. Now it's down to 2 frames, right? We can perceive so much more, so there's so much more stuff being crammed in. Well, when I saw Streets of Fire, I said, these guys actually understand. And we're sort of, I thought, building on the Road Warrior. Don't know if he saw it. I mean, but it was, I saw this sort of quantum leap forward with montage.
I see that.
You know? And I'm seeing that growing. But I do think, you know, I guess you could go back. There were some things he was already doing in The Long Riders that I think were, in some of those gunfights, were they were pretty edgy.
He kept refining it. I'll never forget, when I saw Geronimo in 95, it was earlier than 95, when Hill's film Geronimo came out, I think that was the first Western he'd done since the first straight Western he'd done since The Long Riders, and I was so excited, and I loved the film. But one of the neat things is that he would often have this neat trick. He had found in the editing room a neat trick, and I don't know where it came from originally, but there would be a few frames of white.
Road Warrior.
Is that where it comes from?
In the Road Warrior, there's a couple of those like headbutt type things and stuff where there's a flash of white. And this is pure speculation.
Okay.
But I'm telling you, I know as soon as I saw it, I was trying to steal it. When I was in film school, they used to give every kid in America had to cut a fight scene from Gunsmoke. It was like Marshall Dilling was, and Dennis Weaver was in the scene, and I think the actor John Anderson, I think, so he fights in the scene. It's a big fight scene. And I cut that thing, trying to put flashes of white in, but there was no impactful close-up to make it work, you know?
Yeah.
But I really wanted to get that thing. I just butchered that 16-millimeter work print, you know, trying to George Miller it.
Well, it was one of the great joys of this movie. There's a lot of great joys in Streets of Fire, is that final fight. Who the hell thought, hey, couple of guys going at each other with sledgehammers. That's going to be amazing. And it is, but it's also one of the strangest. If you just say it out loud to a room full of people, the general look you're going to get from everybody is one of complete puzzlement. Really? 2 guys beating on each other with sledgehammers? Yes, beating on each other with sledgehammers. And occasionally hitting a nice 50s car, you know?
And beautifully photographed.
And is that, you know, do you think that's part of the problem? It failed? Because, you know, a sledgehammer fight is such a mashup of so many genres. And you said they're in on the joke. You know, Michael Parade, Walters knows what he's doing here. And the audience didn't know how to handle it at the time. Maybe they could have handled it later. But at the time, it was just such a mixture. And when I just recently, I'm doing a library, film series library. I did some Walter Hill films. And I do a little intro, and then we talk about it afterwards. And there was a lady there. She was, I think she's older than me. But I kind of gave a setup for the film. I say, you know, this is, you know, you need to kind of watch this with a different type of eyes. And da, da, da. And afterwards, she said, I'm so thankful that you told me that because I really enjoyed this film. But she needed the setup because I think if she had just gone into it blindly, she would not probably not. I don't understand this. I don't get this. But once I had set it up a little bit, I didn't want to spoil it, but I thought it needed a little bit of setup depending on the audience, I guess, that you're, you know, it's.
And I think that's the trick is I think real cinema fans are more likely to really enjoy this without any kind of information whatsoever. Just drop them into it and have them just absorb it. But I think for the general public, people who really aren't, you know, real movie people, they right. like movies because everybody likes movies. Yeah. That's one of the more frustrating things for me is, I love movies. Yeah, okay. I'm sure you do.
Yeah.
That's great. Name five directors for me. And you can't do it. So it's nothing. But the more set up, I think that a kind of normal person, I guess is what the phrase I'm looking for, a normal person will have, the easier it would be for them to appreciate it because it is such a... Once you're in the groove, I think you're fine. If you can get online with it, everything is going to flow for you. But
well, and this is probably a stretch, but there's a part of me that looks at it and says, you know, if you look at that time, what was going on with some design, some sort of underground design, like surf punk fanzines and stuff, and you guys know I kind of have these little weird obsessions, but there were sort of like, you know, it's kind of like one of those. It's like one of those, you'd see flyers in L.A. for some underground club, and it would be this... a mashup of, you know, Magic Marker, and it would be on like a bright yellow piece of paper, but then there would be this high con image of the band that, you know, like,
which is very like the poster art.
The poster
art. The Blasters played into that, don't they?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And, you know, and so there was almost a collage, there's almost a mixed media effect, almost a collage effect.
Yeah.
And I think the film has a mixed media approach. And I do think it's, I mean, the only thing missing from this film is like having typeface embedded. You know, I'm doing a lot of my commercials and image films I do now for my clients. I'm embedding text in them. It's just I've become obsessed with it. And I find that retention improves. But
really?
So I'm really, I think, you know, on a personal level, I think I was already gravitating towards a mixed media kind of a thing. When I look at this, I think I can draw a line from this to those like Vertigo comic covers for Sandman or something that were a mix of photograph and painting and type and cut and paste.
Dave
McKean stuff was wonderful. Like Mr. Punch, I think the cover for that, you know, it was very much... Does that make sense?
No. I know where you're going. And you realize these posters, they at the time, because I was collecting everything, and you know, I was a big, I've always been a movie collector, and they had different color versions of this. They had, it would be, this is the most multicolored one. And then there would just be one that was like all blue and all yellow and all, you know.
Kind of, there's an orange one.
And then, of course, I saw your blog where you posted the face one.
Which is weird. It's just Tom Cody's face done in this style. You know? Yeah, it's.
But then look at this. I mean, this is truly for color. This isn't. There's not a lot of nuance in this.
Very basic. Going back to it's play archetypes and the basic structure and characters of the film.
But I think I didn't respond to want to go see the film. Perversely enough, as I love this poster.
Really.
But when it came out, I didn't. Because it didn't look like a movie poster to me, I stupidly was like, "Yeah, this looks like a comic book thing."
It does look like,
you know,
a comic
and I
book
wanted
comic,
the movie to be a movie, and then later on, I'm like, now I just feel, you know, kind of dumb. I wish I'd made it to the theater then.
Honestly, Ted, you're the only person I've ever met who saw the damn thing.
Yeah, I was there for opening weekend. I was there.
Played to crickets in L.A. Yeah. As I recall.
Yeah. I'm sure it was gone in 2 weeks max.
Yeah, it didn't stay long, and like I said, my expectations were so high. It was not. I have a bad problem sometimes with that, and then I have to go back a second time or third time and simmer down, you know, and then it starts playing.
I've learned to temper my expectations no matter how much I expect a film.
No, and it's so rare that anything ever meets my expectations, and that's my problem. And sometimes I remember when The Piano came out, right? You remember the Jim Campion film, The Piano? And it's brilliant, it's brilliant, it's brilliant. And I went to a little art house theater in South Pasadena, and when it was over, all these people were clapping, and I stood up in the back and I go, "What movie did you guys just see? Emperor Has No Clothes. This is terrible." And I thought that movie was just awful. I shouldn't say this.
And
it was just so ponderous, and, you know, and people were like, "Oh, it's brilliant." And no, it's ponderous. It doesn't even have good screen geography. This is not a good film, you know, and
I had the same experience with my buddy Jeff. We went to see The English Patient.
Mm-hmm.
And as the movie goes on, he and I just would occasionally just kind of look at each other like, "Oh, okay." And when it was over, we both had the same reaction, which was, I didn't give a shit about the two main characters because they were both assholes.
Right.
The two main characters were both cheating on their spouses. they were jerks, scumbags. The secondary romance, and it was like, oh, that should have been the movie they followed right there, because I didn't give a damn about these people. Plus, the score would well up when you're supposed to be weeping, and those are the times when we were both looking at each other in the theater going, I don't give a fuck about what they're doing right now. That music needs to be turned down.
I get so excited when a movie actually not only lives up to the hype but exceeds it, and I stumble across them now, lately, like, it's been better. I remember the first movie in a long time that got me excited is I finally had seen Hustle and Flow, and I was like, wow, this movie is actually about something. This movie will take someone who's not particularly interested in, say, in hip-hop or something and get you interested and find common ground, which is great. And, you know, I'm seeing there's some movies now that have got me excited, like American Hustle, you know.
Yeah.
I said, oh, this isn't going to live up to the hype. And then it's like, yeah, it did, you know. And I got Another Earth. Did you guys see that? You know,
yeah.
I love the Monsters. I mean, there's some cool stuff going on out there that is living up to the hype.
One thing that I wanted to say about Streets of Fire that it just occurred to me, this is the first film that I ever saw Willem Dafoe in.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a part of me that thought that he just might be a demon.
You know what I said? I wanted him to play the Joker.
That would have been the first time I saw that.
I looked at my brother and I said, this guy should be the Joker.
Exactly.
Because we were right around the time. I hadn't read The Killing Joke yet, I don't think. But The Killing Joke.
Yeah, 84. This is 1984. Watchmen's on the verge of coming out, and then Killing Joke's right.
Killing Joke is 87, 88, I think.
But I remember reading Killing Joke and going, Willem Dafoe, he's got to play the Joker. He's got to be the Joker. Yeah. And he would have been inspired. I mean, he would have been phenomenal.
Well, there's all kinds of interesting. You know, and Amy Madigan's part was supposed to be a guy.
Oh, it was supposed to be a guy. Right. She came in to read for the sister part, for the part that went to Deborah Van Valkenburgh. And she talked Hill into casting her as the McCoy character, who was supposed to be a middle-aged, overweight guy. And Hill talks about how as soon as she made that suggestion and I thought about it, I was like, you know, that's going to be brilliant. That's going to really work. And it does, because it adds this hard-bitten female ex-soldier to the mix. It's just another element that, yeah, she's playing kind of a stereotype, archetype, whatever you want to call it. But you've not seen a woman play this character before. And in a way, Walter Hill had a hand in Alien and Aliens, of course, a few years after this. Well, exactly. And that's the thing where, Alien ends with, you know, the female who wasn't written as a female surviving. And it's one of those things where I wonder if that was playing in his head. Well, like, you know, it doesn't the gender doesn't necessarily matter. Can the actor carry the role?
Yeah, I think I was reading online that Janet Maslin, I think, was calling the film misogynist or something, and, you know, I'm like, well, you know, get
Amy. How?
Yeah, kind of a switch of the Amy. I mean, right there, and I her scenes with Bill Paxton,
where Amy Madigan's character smacks Bill Paxton around.
Everywhere I go, there's always an asshole.
And it's exactly.
No, it's.
And we haven't even touched on the music, you know, and how the one of the songs became a top 10 hit, you know, out of it. You know, even the movie bombed, but they had a big
hit. The score sold millions of copies.
Yeah.
And so I wonder how many people who owned a cassette or LP of the soundtrack even knew it was a movie. I mean,
to this day, on easy listening stations, I can dream about you. I still hear it. You know,
With Robert Townsend performing.
Yeah.
I know, which is so strange to realize.
To Hollywood Shuffle. My ex-wife worked on Hollywood Shuffle for years on weekends. You know, I was always on the set of that film.
Really?
Because, everybody would just volunteer and go and, you know, years. I mean, I think at least 2 years. I mean, I swear to God, it was forever.
Falls from my eyes. I'm
Let's talk about some of the other cast. Diane Lane was supposedly 18 when she played Ellen Aim, the center around which all this hellishness is spawned. Gorgeous, gorgeous woman. To this day, I think she's just beautiful and incredibly talented. I'm still amazed that she's not gotten more awards because she's very well thought of critically and for reasons. I think she's one of those actresses who's gotten better and better.
She has, but see, and I have this memory of her around this time of actually being criticized a lot. Her performances in Rumblefish was criticized heavily.
But right off the bat, I fell in love with her little romance.
Right.
You know, with Olivia. Lawrence and she made the cover of Time magazine, you know, because of that movie.
Oh, what? Really?
Yeah. She was on the cover.
I think it was Cotton Club that got her really beaten up.
Yeah. She did some.
Everybody got the hell beat out of them.
Yeah, there were some weird choices there, but she. You know, and it took forever before she got cred with that Richard Gere film, and she finally got nominated.
The one in the 90s.
Unfaithful. And it took forever for her to get some credit. I was like, man, I've been with her since the beginning.
Well, you know what brought her back, though, was Lonesome Dove.
Yeah, that helped.
Lonesome Dove.
I haven't seen that in so
great performance and a really raw, you know, she the character on you know, exactly, experienced yeah. a lot of bad things and I think she's incredible. She's
wonderful in this. I mean, and one of the hardest she accomplishes one of the hardest things in the world on film for me to
lip sync.
Exactly. She lip syncs effectively.
Jim Steinman songs.
Which it's one of those things where, I mean, in music videos, with a background in music videos, I mean, to a large degree you can stylistically get away with it not really mattering, but in a film where you're supposed to be watching someone on stage be electrifying and be the center of that much difficult. Attention, it's hard.
And I've done videos where guys didn't give enough in the performance. I mean, you know, I remember where I was telling somebody the other night about working with Robert Plant on something once, and actually he messed with the crew and kind of did something that was really kind of funny, but you could hear him straining to sing over the playback. I mean, he knew if he didn't push it,
then it wouldn't look right. There's no way to make it look right.
But you know, getting back, one thing, there's a great moment. There's a great moment in the final performance of Tonight Is What It Means to Be Young.
Yeah.
And he's at the door and she's watching him across the arena. And then he just, without warning, goes boom. And they cut back to Diane Lane and she just dips her head in the paint. And you know what? The thing that struck me right at that moment is that's what, you know, what they call the Kuleshov effect, where we put two, Kuleshov's theory from back in the 20s Russian cinema, you put two disparate images together that don't, one doesn't mean anything with the other, when you put them together they create an idea.
Right.
Okay. I don't know if she really did that on purpose. We don't know. And it doesn't really matter, because that head drop, and because the way the shot is done is almost like a POV shot, so he's far away, so we're with her. That head drop is just heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. It's an incredible moment.
Yeah, I mean, what about the opening number too, with the lighting and the kids and the audience, you know, and then all of a sudden the lights come on, and all of a sudden it's Defoe. I mean, it's just like you just, you know,
that's what I mean about thinking, my God, is this some demon that Hill conjured up? Because he just seems to float and appear. And then that moment when he screams and rushes the stage at the opening of that film, you're just like, my God, he doesn't look human. He does not look human.
Well, and there's an androgynous quality to it. That rubber,
suit.
I remember being in a club in Montreal one time and seeing two dudes dancing in one of those things. Like, it was like some kind of crazy rave. Getting divorced, and I guess I don't know what the hell I was doing. But, you know, and I'm watching those two guys, and I'm like, oh, my God, you know, it's... they cloned Defoe from Streets of Fire, and these guys are just like, they were sucking on their lollipops and, you know, stomping around.
Ed Begley Jr. shows up in the middle of nowhere looking like a punk, a weird, strange punk in an industrial graveyard.
He's like a bomb that they get some information out of.
How about Rick Moranis?
One of the funnier things is Michael Pare has gone on record talking about this film is that he hated Rick Moranis while they were filming it, because Moranis was just constantly fucking with everybody. Because he's the comedian, and he was constantly cracking jokes and fucking with people. And Pare's like, I just wanted to punch him. I'm like, what's great is whether Moranis wanted to or not, and I'm wondering if Walter Hill may have gone to Moranis and had him do that to create that kind of tension, because the two of them in character in the story are at odds.
Yeah.
And I just, whether that was the intention
look what,
or
look
not,
what Landis did during Animal House, man. He had those guys hating each other.
Yeah.
You know, the frat houses. But, you know, I got to ask the question. I had already made up my mind. I was like, I'm going to ask these guys this. Mm-hmm. did Walter Hill watch Escape from New York? Or did John Carpenter watch The Warriors?
Well, that, and that's interesting, too, because I have a friend and I, we played this little game where we have created this alternate universe where these movies all are in the same universe. I mean, like Escape from New York and Streets of Fire and maybe Blade Runner and maybe Buckaroo Banzai, they all kind of interlock into each other in different time periods. It's the same universe because of just the light, the look of it, the characters, the characterization, the style of mashup.
Earth F for fusion.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly. There you go. But
I just coin that?
I've never heard that before.
Earth
but that,
F.
Yeah.
Well, that was beautiful because like right now DC is actually bringing back all the in the comic book world, they're actually bringing back all those alternate Earths. Earth 2 and Earth
I loved that when I was a kid.
Oh, I know. That's the reason I like DC. I was more of a Marvel guy, but the cool thing was DC had
a pass. Giant
on
past.
A different Earth.
And it was all subset off into these different worlds, and it's like, yeah, well, these characters don't know about that new cool story you know about, but it existed off on this,
And then I discovered that my dad read and collected comic books when he was a kid. I go, Dad, the stories you read were on Earth 2. Mine are on Earth 1. You know, and it was just...
See, you're a good son, because my mom told me a few years ago that she was a Wonder Woman fan. She's like, I read it. I loved Wonder Woman comics. And I said, well, you know what that's all really about.
It's all bondage.
Somebody said to me, they said, why would you do that to your mom? I said, you know what? She did enough things with her guilt-ridden ways. So I got a little shot back. I don't care.
Did you dredge up anything?
She goes, you ruin everything. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you ruin everything.
That's just information she didn't feel she didn't needed, need. Man.
I said, hey, look at the bright side. Mommy invented the lie detector.
Yeah.
Oh, well, you know and have worked with the costume designer.
Marilyn Vance.
So she might, the Diane Lane outfit, mm-hmm, she probably absolutely designed that. Yeah,
Marilyn was just on it then. She was doing all the John Hughes stuff. I mean, she was really driving, in my opinion, she the Untouchables. She won an Oscar.
Well, and, maybe the rubber suit, the DeFoe.
Oh, like, that would absolutely.
That would be the thing to ask her about is like, what did Hill want that prompted you to come up with that costume, I guess?
The duster and
you
all
know,
kinds
if
stuff.
She gets back to me, I'm going to ask her because I'll tell you, she drove, in my opinion, I think Marilyn drove American kids fashion through the 80s in a huge way.
Now you say she won the Oscar for The Untouchables.
For The Untouchables.
What are the films? What are the films she worked on?
You know, she became a producer. I know that because I remember that one. I know she produced that film with Alyssa Milano, where she was a vampire, or there were vampires or something. And I'm embarrassed to say I didn't see it.
The name sounds, you know, vaguely familiar. Actually, now
she.
That
I mean, I know Marilyn did The Breakfast Club. I'm pretty sure. But
she must have had a blast.
Great
on,
taste.
On Streets of Fire, she must have had a blast coming up with all these different mashups and different things.
I would think so. She's just such a stylish, beautiful lady. Used to spend a lot of Halloweens with her. Her late husband and I were very close.
Wow. Die Hard, Predator.
Producer. That's the producer credits.
Okay, so costume designer. Wow, 57
credits. 57
credits
for her.
She directed a couple of flicks, too. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, as costume designer, whoa, okay, Romancing the Stone, Breakfast Club, Brewster's Millions, Weird Science, Pretty in Pink.
A lot of John Hughes stuff.
Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Weird Science.
Some Kind of Wonderful. Predator, Throw Mama from the Train, Die Hard, Roadhouse.
With my buddy Rowdy Harrington.
Amazing. Little movie I remember really enjoying from 89 called The Package with Gene Hackman.
Right.
I know no one else who's seen it even. Pretty Woman. She did Pretty Woman. Wow. Predator 2, Hudson Hawk. The Rocketeer. She did The Rocketeer. Wow, yeah. When you can hear from her, let us know.
That would be interesting. I mean, she talked to Dave Stevens, I bet.
Well, here's another thing about the film. One of the few things I knew about Streets of Fire when I saw it on cable back when it first debuted was I had heard that the entire movie was shot on sets. And when you watch it, you can kind of imagine mm-hmm. that's true.
The back level.
Well, it's that Universal set with that train down
that
the
L,
street.
Yeah,
little train. And they put a tarp on the cover for the night stuff.
Well, apparently they didn't shoot it all on sets. They did actually go to a couple of places. One in Chicago.
Chicago, right, yeah.
And a couple other places to get a couple of different shots. But one of the things that it almost seems like it should feel a bit claustrophobic because you never see the sky.
Right.
Never see this guy, and the entire film seems to take place at night.
Yes, yeah. Raining.
Yeah, and it's almost always raining. And it's one of those things where there's a similarity to the feel and look of it to Blade Runner in that everything does feel kind of artificial, but not in a bad way. It's like a heightened reality that honestly just makes it feel more like the quote-unquote rock and roll fable that it's purporting to be.
Well, everything, like just like the characters, it's reflecting, you know, everything's archetypal. Everything is, you know, he's playing with all these different archetypes through and every level of the film.
There is, you know, it doesn't really open up until that morning sequence when you start to, and if you notice, those are where you start to have some real long lens shots, like the shot, you know, where all the rifles come on, which is totally out of the Warriors too, right?
Yeah.
This is funny. He's like, I've got an idea. I did this. Get me shot number 32. You know?
Well, one of the things Michael Paré talked about is he was one of the things that if you think about it for a second, you realize that all the main actors in the film, there's nobody over 30. There are all these young cats except for the ones who were specifically supposed to be authority types, like the black actor who plays the cop.
Who he's got an interesting little career, I think. And then Rick Rosovich?
Rosovich?
Yeah, Rick Rosovich. He's in it too.
That's right, buddy, and we get the job done. It's like, no, dude, you do not get the job done.
Well, one of the things that I thought was funny, and this is something I've heard from different actors over time about Walter Hill, is that he says, Walter isn't the kind of guy who works well with kids. He's a cowboy. He's like John Ford. Basically, I never saw him tell an actor what to do or how to do it. He expected you to know what to do because the shit was on the page. Now you come in and do it, and I set the cameras up, and if I ask you to do it again, you do it again. And That is that's John Ford. I'll never forget. Have you ever seen that footage of somebody? It was in the 60s. It was later in his career. It may have been Peter Bogdanovich was on set and was actually interviewing John Ford.
Yeah, it's Bogdanovich. Yeah,
and Bogdanovich asks him something about like an underlying theme in one of his earlier pictures, and Ford's whole reaction is, "Oh, that's bullshit. Cut this." And the thing is, if you look at those movies, yeah, Ford thought about this stuff, but he had no interest in talking to you about it.
No, he didn't want to portray himself as the artist.
Yeah.
That was not that generation especially.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to do that.
And Walter Hill very much seems to be that kind of guy. I mean, he got known. I mean, yeah, he wrote Hickey and Boggs, and he wrote several other movies that, you know, got him noticed and got him in the director's chair.
Think about the, you know, archetypes. Think about the driver. They don't have anybody has names.
No one has names.
It's the cop.
It's the driver, the cop.
Right there, he's telling you away.
Yeah,
this is, you know, he's giving you a clue how to watch this thing.
Right.
You know. So I think he's doing, again, Streets of Fire, he's dealing, playing with that, but adding some of the more interesting, varied colors to it.
So. It was a shock to me to find out that he hoped to be able to do sequels to this.
Yeah, a trilogy.
A trilogy of following Tom Cody to different places, doing different things. And
I watched this and I was like, why doesn't anybody understand we can do Batman like this?
Yeah.
You know, like, this is a Crime Alley picture, you know what I mean? Because I hate how like every superhero movie, like the world is going to blow up.
Yeah.
As if one death couldn't be a Holocaust, you know? And I mean, can you imagine? I mean, you could have, you know, this could have been Batman and Vicki Vale and it would have worked.
True. And honestly, that opening of Burton's 1989 Batman film, those sets look like the Streets of Fire sets to me. The whole thing where you're seeing the two criminals mug the couple and then get to the roof and start, you know, deciding who gets what out of the wallet. Those look like the Streets of Fire sets to me. I don't know if they actually were, but that's what they look like.
I don't know where they shot.
Was
it in London, maybe?
The Gotham?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Because it was built by what's his name?
Not a fan.
It's not a Tim Burton film. It's not a Batman film. It's a Tim Burton. I was also getting back to Streets of Fire. Also, here's another thing we should keep in mind. When Walter says, "I tried to make what I thought was a perfect movie when I was in my teens."
Oh yeah, he said something about it's got everything. It's got knife fights and gun fights and people kissing in the rain.
Well, yeah, I put it all the things I thought were great then, and which I still think are great affection for: custom cars, kissing in the rain, neon, trains in the night, high speed pursuit, rumbles, rock stars, motorcycles, jokes in tough situations, leather jackets, and questions of honor.
Oh, you just reminded me of something. Something you said earlier reminded me that. About the character Tom Cody and him not really thinking of himself as a hero, but still being that guy who puts on a show. The sequence where he's told McCoy before they go in to rescue the girl, well, yeah, their motorcycles don't go very far when they have giant holes in them. So you know what he plans to do. But he's already doing that by the time he walks down to street level and just starts blowing the shit out of them at close range, almost as if he's daring people to look at him and to see that it's me doing this to you. And that's understood by Raven, the character Willem Dafoe plays, who walks out there and everything's decimated and he just asks for his name. And it's one of those beautiful
actions. Pleased to meet you.
Yeah, Tom Cody, pleased to meet you.
Looks like I finally found someone who likes to play as rough as I do.
It's one of those beautiful.
It must be your lucky day.
It's a beautiful moment. It's one of those. I think it's about the midpoint of the film, and you realize, oh, it's just gonna get better from here. Yeah. It's already good. It's just he's blowing shit up, and they pulled this off, and they're about to get away.
And you get the well-worn storylines of the loner hero, and he's picking up an entourage as he goes along.
Yes.
Elizabeth Daly gets picked up, and she's the fangirl.
Right.
And then you get the African-American group, I forget what their name is.
Oh, the Sorrells?
Sorrells. The bus, and they just keep on picking up more and more as they go along to, you know, as like Josie Wells, and Clint keeps on, you know, grabbing up entourage as he goes along.
And Cody is constantly dickish to them at all times. even when you see him gain a little bit of respect for the Sorrells after they sing, he leaves them alone. Yeah. But at first, he's just dismissive of them.
Get a little smile, I think, out of him.
Exactly. And he's like, okay. And so he's not going to antagonize them. Yeah. But when he comes back to get his money, after they've gotten back, to get his money from Moranis' character, he sees that that little hanger-on fangirl is still there.
Yeah.
And he has one line to her, which is, what are you still doing here? Just with utter contempt. Right. It's actually perfect because, yeah, that's exactly how he'd react.
Yeah.
What the hell are you still doing here? I do love this film.
And then I'm curious about this Albert Pion, how you say his name?
Oh, Albert Pion.
This bizarre airs that sequel that it's done. Have you heard about this?
What is it?
Okay, this was a complete...
I met him here in Louisville at a Phantom Fest, and he talked about it.
Okay, it's Albert Pion. He's a guy who has made...
Captain America. Sword and the Sorcerer.
And that Captain Cyborg. And that Captain America movie.
J.D. Salinger.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, J.D. Salinger's kid, Matt Salinger.
But it's called Road to...
Road to Hell. Unofficial sequel called Road to Hell is made in 2008. And Perry, Michael Perry, played
and his
Conan.
Partner Cynthia Curran. You know her, but anyway, she's his partner, and they got a Perry showed up. They got some permission. They got to use some Steinman songs. And he's called Cody, and Deborah Valkenburg shows back up in it as.
Oh, I didn't
sister.
Know that.
Yeah, look
that's
at the
crazy. I got to track this down.
Yeah. That's just it. I don't know.
Well,
anyone who's seen it.
She showed it at a festival.
And I always thought Pune was cool, though, man. I always thought he was like doing.
There was some interesting.
There was some cool stuff that he was doing
because
it always his films felt like he was, you know. He was like I don't want this to come out the wrong way because I don't mean it that way, but it was sort of like this informed fanboy approach to what he was doing. He actually, when you saw stuff that he did, you knew that he actually got the source, you know, unlike, you know, so many.
But
he's
been showing up at some, they showed it at a festival and they showed it at a Alamo Drafthouse. A version of it.
I want to see this.
So yeah, I'm dying to. I think I'm Facebook friends with her. I need to. I was almost going to contact her and say we're going to do a podcast on this, but I was so excited about. In fact, I talked about that and some other stuff that I totally forgot he did the Captain America movie until after I left that weekend. I was like, oh, I could have talked about Captain America with him. So
the listing for it, 2012 is a release date that this is giving. So
and there's the poster for it.
Wow,
a lot of green screen.
Have to go downstairs.
Yeah, there's a lot of green screen on it too.
Dick on it, I'm having fun.
So.
Deborah Van Valkenburg is in it. This is bizarre. This movie actually exists.
Yeah, it did. It's been shown. The Alamo Drafthouse and a festival. They got an award too, I think, at some place.
This means nothing, but look at the 8.3 listing on IMDb. That either means three people who really like it saw it, or
it may 658 people voted on it.
And it's got an 8.3?
Yeah.
It's probably the fans of Streets of Fire that just want to keep Cody alive.
We're gonna have to see this, see if it's any good. That's bizarre.
Sorry.
But yeah, I got a chance to talk to him in person about that, and they were still working on it, and I just they did get some permission to do what they were able to do. I mean, it's sort of under the radar, but they didn't. They're not violating anything, I think. They were okay with them doing what they, you know, what they did.
Wow.
So.
Well, this is one we're going to have to track down, guys.
Yes.
I do not know this film. Road to Hell, 2012 release date.
Yeah, it's. I don't think it's got a video release or VOD, and it's only been shown two or three times. And each time, I think they tweaked it each time, you know, festival, and then they tweaked it again. The Alamo Drafthouse tweaked it again.
Well, I know what that's all about.
Looks like she's drugging a real crowd, don't it?
Sure does.
like it's gonna be a full house tonight.
Hey, what do you say we run and check out the show?
How we doing here? We all set?
Hey, big crowd, huh?
Yeah, and one of them's got a pot to piss in. I never should have let myself get talked into this dumb benefit. I could be making some real money tonight. All right, let's get this thing started.
But yeah, for those listening, you should check out Streets of Fire. I mean, if you haven't,
if you never have, yeah, it's worth your time.
Yeah, and one other thing I was going to say, they really did try to push it big, and then when it came on VHS, they actually released a separate VHS of the music videos and the making of it. A separate.
Oh, I didn't know that.
At the time, I was one of the video stores at the time, and
so it makes sense considering
the soundtrack and the soundtrack.
I think that they had gotten out a little too out in front of music videos and didn't quite. And it's what happens so often is people, something comes in and the establishment wants to do something with it, but they don't really know what it is yet. You know, it's like when people set out to make schlock movies, you know, or like when we made Surf Nazis Must Die. You know, a lot of people come back and they go, man, were you guys really trying to do a trauma movie? No, we were trying to make the best B movie that we could. I mean, the things that are wrong with that movie are when our reach exceeded our grasp. There weren't, because we were deliberately trying, you know.
Yeah.
You don't set out to, you don't set out to make Psychomania. You get lucky and you make it. And, you know, and then you just happen to do something that's so cool that.
Yeah, you're doomed if you think you're going in to make a cult film. That will kill it.
Oh, that'll kill it.
And there may have been some of that at work here, a little, but I don't think so. I mean, I certainly don't think so. There was with Buckaroo Banzai you mentioned earlier, which just. We all discovered on cable and went, why the hell did we go see this in the theater? You know,
it's because it
cool.
played for a
well,
week.
Well, that happened, the same thing happened to that. They promoted that thing in the Olympics that summer. It was supposed to be Fox's big summer film. And all of a sudden they dumped it at the end of the year. I had to go to Terre Haute to see it.
I still feel that is such a bizarre film that it could have done a lot better if they'd handled it. If they put it out in the summer and they'd done some promotion.
See, but I got to tell you something. Our hindsight is 20/20.
Yes.
Yeah, true.
And what we are losing sight of is, and I say the establishment because I don't know what else to call them, but the powers that be, you know, there are movies that have been made that I can remember going in and pitching 20 years ago, and people were like, nothing like that's going to work. And then somebody else finally got a crack in and did it, and it worked. They didn't even understand how to get to these fan bases. They didn't understand where there were niches. They didn't understand.
Yeah.
There were a lot of things that could have been done that weren't done. Because, you know, I think you still were having a hangover from the time of the 40s, you know, when the studios could just put their stuff right in a theater. You know, the cultures really hadn't changed yet, you know, and not in the way that they've changed now, you know, where, I mean, I told a producer, he was complaining about something. I said, you know, the problem is you can't write, you can't shoot, you don't know how to light, you can't direct, you can't edit. What if you can't write a check? You serve no purpose.
Wow, yeah.
And he was a friend. I mean, we were just talking, and I said, and I'm making sure that I can still do all of those things because so that I can keep doing this. But, you know, and people were still angry. I'll hear people, producers, they'll say things, you know, and I don't understand why I can't just go to Cannes and pre-sell these markets because it's not 1995.
Yeah.
VHS is gone. DVD is gone. We're living in this new world, and we're figuring out how to monetize it and stuff. And I think people looked at Streets of Fire and studios, and they said, "Oh, we're going to make an hour and a half or 2 hour music video." They didn't even know what a music video was. Walter Hill did,
yeah.
You know, and you saw people catch hell for that. You know, like they grabbed Russell Mulcahy. You know, we need you to do this. You know, and then when he made Highlander, because it's just a big music video. No, it wasn't. It was just a movie. He was just a visualist. He did what was right for the whatever the thing was. You know, it just and when they stopped working. You know, it's convenient to want to say, well, you know, now Russell's not working because of X, Y, Z. Russell's not working because one movie didn't make the money they wanted to make, and then you're out because they just want to plug this next guy in. And I'll give you a last word on this for me. What they should be doing is having guys make a movie every 8 months. Because you know what? The guys that make a movie all the time, with the Woody Allens and that, and I'm not taking anything away from his genius or whatever, but the reason he still makes good movies is because he's always making movies.
Mm-hmm.
Spielberg makes good movies because he's always making movies.
Carpenter said, you know, John said, I always wish I was in the studio system because I'd be on the next film and the next film.
You know, it's
film.
Easy for me to say it because they don't invite me in, you know, so, you know, I work where I work. But you know what? I now, because I shoot constantly on whatever, you know, it is, I see my work is clearly getting better because I'm shooting all the time.
Practice makes perfect in a way.
It absolutely does. Yeah. And also what it forces you to do is to say, I'm going to reinvent, I'm going to try to do this, or I'm going to try to do that. Unless you're in the studio system where they're saying to Walter Hill, why do you want to do that? We want a Walter Hill picture. You know, if we're not going to have people going from point A to point B, why are we hiring Walter Hill? Well, maybe because, you know, he's a really good director. And maybe there's a lot of things he could do. But that's where the system becomes so rigid and I think grossly inefficient. You know, this sort of what I call the mutual fundification of movies where, you know, we're going to manage risk. I mean, I remember when Aaron Brockovich came out and it was like there were two studios. It was like, what was it, Sony and Universal? Or something? I can't remember. There were two studios that were required to put that deal together.
Really?
Like, Julia Roberts movie at the peak of her career, and you're so cowardly that it took two studios to make it?
Didn't Clint have problems getting funding for $1 Million Baby?
Oh, yeah.
Warner Brothers, its own studio.
Oh, yeah.
And so they, we don't really, you know.
They're trying to do risk management, and, you know, it's difficult to create art in an atmosphere of fear. And, I'm sorry. Yeah.
No. So, it's all relevant to this film, because that's one of the reasons why.
They gave the only reason he got the green light because those 48 Hours did so well.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if they hadn't done well.
No, and they were real fascinated with MTV.
Yeah,
You know, and the cultural shift isn't even appreciated like it was. I remember my ex-wife was a DP, and her agent represented director of photography on commercials. And she snapped on me one day, and she said, you guys are ruining it for everybody. And I said, what are you talking about? She goes, because commercials, we had a way to make a lot of money. We would sit, we would take our time, we'd do all this stuff. And now they're looking at what you guys are doing, and you're doing it for a tenth of the cost. And you go, and it was like, and I said, you know what you're afraid of? We work. We work hard.
Well, you know what I just flashed on? The MTV, what MTV did to movies in the 80s is similar to what happened to the movie industry in the 60s when musicals died the death of the damned. And the studios, honestly, the studios didn't know what the fuck to do and just started throwing, okay, what can we do? What can we do? What can we do? Because these old guys knew the old way of doing things, but they didn't know what the hell was going to sell anymore. So they still producing, you know, Dr. Dolittle and Hello Dolly, and they're coming out and making nothing. And somebody comes along and makes this little biker picture, and it makes more money than they can even dream of. So they don't know what the hell they're doing. So they just immediately start going, okay, we don't know what you guys are doing. But it's making money, so here.
Just go
and
do
the,
it.
And the same thing started happening with music.
Well, you know,
video
I love that. I love
In
the Big Picture, which is a film I love. You know, Kevin Bacon. You know, the
Christopher Guest.
Chris Guest picture, and at one point, and I talked to J.T. Walsh before he died about this. We were at a party, and I was like, I love this film, and I love what you do, because he goes, I don't know what you do, but I want you to do it for me. And then, who else is in that? Who plays the crazy agent? What's his name? Martin Short. You know,
Short? Okay.
Is it Martin Short? He's the one who says it, I think. It's not JT, actually. I think it's Martin Short. He's like, I don't know what you do, but I want you to do it for me. All right. I'm in deep trouble.
All right, guys. Thank you very much for sitting down to talk about this movie.
Love it.
Thanks.
Fellas, I'm going to run down there. Okay. Thanks so much, man.
Hey,
that was great.
That's great.
Thanks. So, have you seen any of my comic books?
But I love my baby like a bulldog loves his bone. And last night she got crazy, she called me up on the phone. She said, come on over, daddy, cause I hate to drink alone. She said, I had to have a little more. Well, I tried to get up, I could not get out the door. Another big old snake crawling right across the floor. And I told her, hold that snake till I make it. Hold on till your daddy gets there. His head is shaking till he ain't going nowhere. Take it, but take it, don't let go of that snake till I make it. My baby's not afraid to take a chance. Drinking whiskey starts to think about romance. And that's when she wants, but I keep in my pants. I know she's got a few tricks up her sleeve. I mean, she gets hot. We'll be right back.
And that's going to do it for episode 14 of The Bloody Pit. Hope you enjoyed it. If you've ever or never heard of Streets of Fire, and I want to thank Ted and Bob again for participating. Of course, we were squeezing it into our schedules at a convention in Kentucky, so trying to wedge it into everything else was not the easiest thing, and I'm just glad that they made the time to do this. If you have any comments, want to write in about any of the podcasts here at The Bloody Pit, please drop me a line, thebloodypit@gmail.com. Glad to hear from you. Always looking for new participants. Thank you once again, and we will see you next time.